The aim of the lectures is to try and understand the invention of the modern world, the largest topic I can think of, how we got here, who we are, and where we are going, which is of such importance, particularly to the great nation of China, because you will be leading the world in this coming years, and it will be useful for you to know where the world you are leading came from, so that you can do that wisely. If you remember, I suggested that the modern world is a miracle. It was very unlikely to happen. In order to unlock it, you had to have a key which was just right, just the right combination of characteristics. The chance of having this was a million to one or more. And if it hadn't happened, I believe, in England in the 18th century, it's not just a matter that, well, we would have had it in the 19th or 20th century, somewhere else. It would have never happened. We would still be living in an agricultural world. And the way I'm approaching it is, I seem for some reason, as I see this diagram here, to have left a lot of blanks here, but that wasn't intentional. As I'm doing it, I'm thinking of this as a jigsaw puzzle, and in each lecture I'm giving you parts of the jigsaw puzzle. In the first, what is the question? And the question for me is the origin of the modern world, and specifically of a world in which, in theory at least, we separate our political, economic, religious, intellectual, and social world from each other. That is the ideal of modernity, splitting, separating, tension between them, because of course they always want to come together again, because our lives are together, and we force them apart. Very difficult to maintain for long, usually collapses within two or three generations. So that is the question. The first part was war, trade and empire, the British Empire and its warlike nature and its trading. Then the origins of the Industrial Revolution, which occurred in England for the first time 50 years before anywhere else, and propelled the empire forth. Then the origins of capitalism, which again, as Weber said, first occurred in England and it occurred about 300 years before Weber thought. In other words, the 12th, 13th centuries, leading to a very rich material world, very good clothes, very good food, very good houses, and drink, of course, which was based on accurate knowledge, on reliable knowledge of what people call science and universities. And then the last lecture, I looked at caste and class, the very mobile, the extraordinary system that Tocqueville noted for England, whereby no one was of a fixed position. They were constantly trying to go up or stop going down. And this led to the dynamism, I think, of capitalist societies in England, and was, in a way, associated with, not caused by, but associated with an attitude towards play, towards games, sport, hobbies, and so on. So this is the phenomenon, and this is beginning to try and explain why it occurred, social features. And as Professor Liu kindly pointed out, this two lectures are continuing that to do with social relations, family and civil society. Now, in almost all societies, the household, that is, the symbols of anthropology, by the way, I didn't explain to you, but this is a male, this is a female, this is marriage, this is having children. So in a normal 90% of human societies, this group here, plus perhaps their parents, the man's parents, up here, which is called an extended family, three-generational family, grandparents, one of their children, and grandchildren. That is the unit which is the basic unit of society. In China, India, France, anywhere. And it unites all parts of life. It is the group who work together, they run the family farm. It is the group who pray together, they have their ancestor shrines and their family rituals. It is the political group. In Confucianism, the father is the political head of the family. So here's the king within this little kingdom. And obviously it is the social group. This is why pre-modern societies, as I've said, are not split apart, because the family is not split apart. It is all one unit. What is called in anthropology the domestic mode of production, domestos, meaning household. So these are peasant societies with a domestic mode of production, but it doesn't just apply to the peasants. It also applies to rich people as well. So the basic unit, if you had to say, what is the building block, the fundamental unit or brick on which the social world and the empire is built, as Confucius would no doubt say, it is the family. That means that no individual is separate. This person has no meaning, the son, except in relation to the other parts. He has no individual personality or rights, as I mentioned before, in the land. He is without his father, he has no access to the ancestors. He is alone and unprotected politically. So there is no meaning in an individual. There is only meaning in relation to other close relatives. And every action that you take in life is simultaneously a social action. If you, just in the simple transaction, when you give out a meal to your family, this is not just food. It is symbolic of politics, religion, it's a ritual, it's a political statement. They're all bound together. Now, if you think about your own families, you're probably in a transition state, many of you in China. China is in a very interesting half and half world now. But thinking about my background in England and the West, which has had a modern family system for a long time, as I'll explain, the family doesn't act as the infrastructure. It doesn't organize politics, economics, or religion. Somehow the family has become separated out, the members of the family have become separated out. And the family has lost more or less all its functions. For example, my wife and I here, we have three daughters. But if I said to one of my daughters, you vote Conservative, or you vote Labour, because I tell you, as your father, they look at me and say, you've gone mad, Alan. If I said to one of my daughters, I'm getting old, I want you to come and work in my garden and work for me, they'd say, no, why should we? Actually, one of them is very kindly helping us in the garden, but we've arranged to pay for her to do that, because, you know, why should she do it? She's got other things to do. Likewise, if we said to one of our children, you must believe in my kind of religion and you must come to our house and you must pray to our ancestors and so on, again, they would think I was going completely crazy, too much anthropology or too many travels have gone to my head. So basically, this is not a unit of anything. It's not an economic unit, it's not a political unit. It's a collection of individuals who have their meanings in themselves. So in this case, the microcosm, the small unit which reflects the macrocosm, the wider society in the West, is the individual. Just one person. This is why, as I mentioned in the last lecture, Robinson Crusoe is the ideal Englishman. Just one person. You don't need anyone else on the desert island. If you were in China or Japan or somewhere, you need the whole family there to make it possible to really be a full, contented human being. But in England, you can have one person on an island, and that's enough. And each person in our situation has individual rights and individual duties. Here you don't have individual rights and individual duties. You have social rights and social duties in relation to other people. And to go into that in a little more detail, and covering ground I've partly covered, at the heart of this in capitalism is the absence of family property. Maitland, who was a great historian of England, noted that to the modern Englishman, our modern law, which allows the father to leave his children penniless, that's without any money, seems so obvious that he will apt to think it deep-rooted in our national character and, you know, a universal kind of thing. But in fact, it's a great peculiarity of world cultures. England is the only country which historically, for a long period, had a situation where anyone could leave their children without any money at all, or leave them with nothing, no possessions. Probably the Anglo-Saxons, that's over a thousand years ago, but certainly from the 13th century, which is 700-800 years ago, children had no automatic rights in a parent's property, as I've mentioned elsewhere. A child could be disinherited up to the moment of their parent's death. They could leave a will, they could sell the property, give it away, do what they like until they die. So there is no family property. You're not born into a unit which owns property. You do not at birth, as you do in peasant societies. The moment you are born, you have rights in this family property. Here you don't have any rights at birth of that kind, to family property. You have other rights as a citizen, but not that. All the property is individualized, except that of husband and wife, who have some shared rights, including the fact in England that after a husband's death, a wife would have traditional rights of what is called widow right, or free bench and courtesy, as it was called. Free bench meant you had a right to some place to live, and courtesy, some other bits of food or support. So in some parts of England, you had a widow would have a third of her husband's property automatically, and others a half. That's the only kind of automatic right. In France and elsewhere, you had something called the restraint of the line, the lineage, which is the various generations of a family, could had a kind of right in the family holding, so that when a person died, the cousins and the others had some rights in it, the restraint or restraint lineage. There is no restraint of the line in England. No one can demand shares in the parents' property. Now that I've mentioned, but something which has increasingly interested me and surprised me, and it may surprise you also, is how is it that in most societies people form this very strong family group, but in England it's broken up so that it becomes unimportant, relatively unimportant. Important psychologically, but not in material and practical ways. And the secret to this is a very, very strange institution, which is not found in anywhere else in the world except England historically, but is beginning to be found with you in China. This is the custom of breaking the family early on in life by sending children away from home, to live away from home. In a peasant society, you are born in a certain village, you grow up in the family, you stay in the family, you marry and maybe move to a neighbouring house or nearby, but you stay there until you're 20, 21, and you never really move away from your parents, even if physically you partly move away from them. The family does all the socialising. It teaches you your life skills, your morality, your ethics. This is why, for example, Confucius made and Chinese law made such an emphasis on the responsibility of a family to bring up children properly. If you've committed a crime, as you know, in traditional China, it wasn't just a matter of punishing the person who committed the crime, but all their relatives, particularly their parents, would also be punished because they should have brought them up better. In England, in law today, and all through English history, parents have not been responsible for their children. They still aren't. If a 20-year-old child in England commits an offence, it's them who are punished. If a policeman knocked on your door and said, your daughter has committed an offence and she was 21, you must come to court and be punished, we'd think they'd gone crazy. It's nothing to do with us, they're separate people. And it's nothing to do with our failure as parents to have brought them up properly, because that was the responsibility of other people, i.e. the school and the society more generally. Because in modern societies, I've been writing them for a long time, it is the wider society that socializes the individual. And this is because children are sent away from home very early. They're taken out. And this is terribly important because to disengage, to split, break up this unit, to separate the economic from the social, which is the basis of capitalism, as Faber says, is a very painful and difficult thing to do. Because we love our children, they love us. How is it that we can tear them and wrench them apart? All mothers know the pain of losing their children at some stage in their life. And English mothers knew this from very early on in their lives. They knew this from the age of 7, 6, 7, 8, 9. That's the sort of age. They're taken out, children are taken out of the family at that age and are brought up by non-family. They're not just sent to their brother's household or a cousin. They're sent off to strangers. And this is done, depending on the level of the society, in different ways. If you were in the sort of 30, 40, 50% of the population who are quite poor, you were sent off as a servant to work for another family, in another family. It's a strange system, which I'll come back to, whereby you bring in a distant stranger as a servant, maybe the same age almost as your own children, and you send your own children to someone else's household. So you bring in a servant, and you send your own daughter off somewhere else, exchange it. Seems crazy, why not keep your own daughter and let her do the things that servants do? But you don't. If you're a little higher up the social, in the sort of middle class, then you realise that your children need to learn a profession or a craft or a trade, so you send them off as apprentices, what we call apprentice, where for 7 years you're bound to work for someone, they teach you the skills, and when you have finished the apprenticeship, you can practice that skill, so you might become a baker or a butcher or whatever it is. And again, you'll have an apprentice coming into your household, and your own son will go off to be an apprentice in another household. If you're in the upper middle class, then you'll go to school and university. And this is the foundation of the British public school and boarding school system. which is the oldest institution in England, I'll talk about it more later, goes back to about the 7th century, i.e. 1200, 1300 years ago, the first boarding schools which were attached to Manasseh, to church, big churches, like St. Paul's and Westminster Abbey and so on. They had schools, boarding schools, where people came and were taught. By the 13th, 14th century, you had a number of big, famous boarding schools, and then many more were founded. But what is perhaps even more strange, and no one much has commented on, is the fact that the public schools, which take children, places like Eton and Harrow and Winchester, which have children between the age of 13 and 18, that's pretty strange. What's even stranger is that they have, in order to get into those schools and to be able to manage those schools, you have what's called preparatory schools or prep schools. And there were thousands and thousands of these preparatory schools. At the beginning of the 19th century, the time of Jane Austen, there were something like 20,000 preparatory schools, some tiny, some bigger, in England. And these preparatory schools, prep schools as they're known, took boys and sometimes girls from the age of 8. I went to my preparatory school at the age of 8 3/4, away from home, boarding. These are boarding schools. So I was ripped out of my household at the age of 8, put in with strangers, where you are cut off from all your kin and your neighbours and your friends, and you are alone with strangers for 3/4 of the year. My parents were away in India, as was often the custom, and I went to this kind of school. What happened is that when you were ripped, and if you were very, in the past, if you were among the aristocracy, the top few families, you might be sent off, until quite recently, to be privately tutored as a page, that is, as a kind of honorary servant for a noble family. So a number of the noble families would have other noble families' children as their pages. What this did was to break the family, but also to begin to teach you to be an independent, free, equal citizen. This is the first training in democracy, in a way, in England. All these are, because you are no longer subject to the power of your parents. People have to persuade you. Your master at school or your master as an apprentice has to negotiate with you. He can't do many things. You have rights, you have responsibilities, you have duties, and you are on your own. You don't have your brothers and sisters with you, anyone. You are on your own. You are, in a sense, an adult in some ways, from the age of 8. Rather than being an embedded member of a family. Now, when a Venetian ambassador came to England to be the ambassador in the early 16th century, about 1500, 1498, he observed as one of the main and strange features of England this pattern of sending children off. He said the English are very cruel to their children. They send them away at the age of 8 or 9 to other people's households. And he said this would be maybe understandable if they sent them away for a few years and then they took them back into their households like normal Italians or anyone else does. But their cruelty is such that they never bring them home again. Once you've left home, psychologically and socially like this, you never come home. And this was the same in my case. I was sent off at 8. I went for 5 years to a preparatory school. Then at 13 I went to a boarding school, and at 18 I went to university. Of course I spent holidays at home, but they are holidays. The real business of life is in the school, And it is the school that is training you for life. This was observed by many Frenchmen. It's the great difference between England and all continental countries, as he observed, that in France or Italy or Spain or Germany, the unit of socialization, the people who give you your morals and your standards and your training for life, is the family. And this is why all the continental nations are familistic. They are based on the family. The family is very strong, much stronger in France than in England. And he said that the reason why, if you look at English education, if you look at boarding schools in England, they seem to be partly about intellectual matters. They're teaching them something, but they're mainly about character formation. They're mainly about games, sports, learning to be a leader, music, all the other things. They are, in effect, extended families which are teaching you life skills and social skills. And he said this is not the case in France, from which he came. The school is just an intellectual matter. It's not a place to train character. That happens at home. But this is a very great difference. And one effect of the difference is, of course, on your emotional character and particularly on love and marriage. If you stay inside this nuclear family or family, in a traditional peasant society, when the daughter is ready to be married, which is often at the age of 12, 13 at puberty, who is going to decide who she marries? Well, obviously, she is still in the power of her father and mother. She's living at home. She's only going to move to the next village, maybe. There are important political and economic consequences of her marriage. If she marries the wrong person or doesn't get the diary or whatever it is, or the bride will often diary and so on. So the marriage is crucial to this family. And it's even more crucial, perhaps, the son's marriage, because the son's wife will have to survive with his mother-in-law. So in that situation, in the 90% of human societies based on the family, marriages are arranged. They are economic, political, and social, and to a certain extent religious events, which are arranged by the parents. In England, you have this daughter has gone off to another town, the son's gone off to another town, probably, or another faraway village. Is now on their own, they've had their education, they're adults in many ways. And in this other town, they meet the son, goes for a walk one day and sees a beautiful maiden. Looking after her flock of sheep in nearby, and he says, "Ah, this is a beautiful maiden. What is your name?" And so on, all the love poetry, and you'll know what. And he falls in love. They fall in love. He then goes back to his parents here, and says, "I've fallen in love with this beautiful maiden." And they say, "Well, is she what she like?" And bring her to see us. If they approve, that's fine. If they disapprove, as you see in many English novels, there is then a battle. As you see in verse in Jane Austen, where sometimes the lady, Mrs. Bennet of this world, tries to half arrange a marriage for the daughters, or in Charlotte Bronte or elsewhere. And they can't force their children. They can suggest things, but their children can reject it. If the children are absolutely set on getting married, then again, the parents can't do anything about it. You can legally marry without your parents' consent after the age of 18. And so what draws you together is not an arrangement, but love. And if you look at this phenomenon of social, of love, This goes back in England to Anglo-Saxon times again. There was a lot of Anglo-Saxon log poetry, and certainly through the 12th, 13th, 14th centuries, love is a very strong theme in English literature. I've written a book on marriage and love in England, starting in the 13th, 14th century. And it's quite evident from all the sources, from letters and everything else, that romantic love is very old in England, and it is the basis of 80% of the English literature, poetry, novels, and so on and so on. And of course, Shakespeare's plays. It wasn't invented by Shakespeare. It was there 300-400 years before. And it fits, as you can see, with this kind of world. You are attracted to someone, just as you are attracted to a certain place or a certain job. And the effect of all this is that English, very strong bond, this, the individual choice of a partner, means that England moved to a situation where this, the strongest tie was, this is known as companionate marriage, where you have a companion, a friend, a soulmate. The English metaphor is for the blood to be joined. When you marry in England, you become one blood and one spirit, not just the two bloods joined together. And so you have this love marriage based on attraction and then companionship. And this becomes more important than any other relationship. In Japan or China or in India, the relationship between his son and his mother is stronger, traditionally, than between the son and his wife. In Japanese novels, the late 19th century and early 20th century, you get cases of the mother-in-law saying, "I don't like the daughter-in-law, get rid of her." And I'm sure you find this in Chinese literature. That couldn't happen in England. Partners couldn't be divorced, but you can't do that. So, get this. And this is the unit. The other effect is that you begin to get a situation, or you have had for a long time, a situation of resources and wealth flowing down the generations. You bring up your children, you educate them, you pay for them until they've left their schooling to a certain extent. And you expect nothing back, and you probably will get nothing back. You provide for them. They're like, say, birds. Birds bring up their infant, their nestlings, the baby birds, and then the baby birds fly away, and they don't look after their parents later on. This was what the English thought of. Their children were like little baby birds, and they flew away, and that was the end of it. In the majority of these other societies where so much revolves around it, you have a system of resources which flows upwards. So the children, there have been many economic and demographic studies which show that children return more to their parents than their parents give to them, because you have an obligation to go on working on the family farm, looking after your parents in their old age and so on. So children are an economic investment. In the majority of societies, they're a good and probably the best way to invest is in children, and hence large families and high fertility. In England, they're not a good investment at all. They're a luxury. They're regarded in England as kind of pets, superior pets, like you can keep a cat or a dog, or you can keep a daughter or a son. And sons and daughters are probably better than pets in many ways, but they also have their drawbacks, as people pointed out. So that is the difference. And the last point about the family that I want to make is that, which has already been implied, if you're sending all your children away, still in the pre-industrial world, there's a lot of work to do around the house. Who's going to do this work? You've sent your children off. Who's going to come in and milk the cows and sweep the house and do all these sorts of things? In England, there was, and has been for 800 years, a very strange phenomenon which has been described by one historian as the servant mode of production. Only in England, and to a certain extent Japan and Holland, you had very large numbers of servants, different kinds. Some work in the farm, some work in the house. The ones who work in the house are like children in one sense. They live in the bedroom that the children have left, maybe. They live within the family, they eat with the family, they are within the family, and yet they're servants and they're paid. So you have introduced wage labour and the market economy right inside the heart of the family. Servants were terribly important, something like almost all middle class families would have servants until the early 19th century. They've obviously faded out largely now, but they were a very important feature of life. Many people started life as servants and then had servants themselves later in their lives. Which takes me on now, finally, to friendship. I'll skim over this fairly quickly, and if you're interested in this, when the book comes out, there's much more about friendship there. In England, because the family was really rather weak, you're sent off to school and so on. Who are the people who are going to be important in your life? They're not going to be your family. If you talk to a young child now, say my granddaughter Lily, ask her who are the important people in her life, she'll start naming all her friends at school. Friendship is really what English society is about. Friend is an Anglo-Saxon word, and it is the heart of English culture, friendship. Terribly important. And yet, if you look cross-comparatively, if you had asked a young Indian or a young Chinese, say 100 years ago, about friendship, they probably wouldn't even be the word for friendship in the same sense as the English word for friendship. Certainly it would be much less important. Their family is what's important. Because friendship in the English sense, I think it's slightly different from Guangxi, for example, in Chinese. What friendship is an equal relationship. There's an equal long-term relationship of mutual liking or mutual interest. You can't have an instrumental friendship. You can't make friends with someone because they are going to be useful for you. They may be useful for you, and that may be one side product of it, and it may be that out of some activity like working together or being to the same school or whatever, you become friends. But the real thing is that you like to be with that person. You like to exchange. This is why we talk about married friends. Your closest friend is your husband or wife. And then, otherwise, there are lots of friends who you really enjoy being with. Doesn't mean you spend your whole time talking. There are nice descriptions, for example, of English friends who play golf together. Year after year, they go down to the golf club and they play a round of golf together. They never talk to each other, really. They just, hi, should we start then? And then they play golf and then they go. But that gives meaning to their lives, that closeness. So many friends are almost unspoken, and friendship is indicated not by large actions, but by very small actions. I had a very, very deep friend with whom I wrote a book on glass, Jerry Martin, and we became friends later in our lives. And we did talk a lot. But what really struck me about Jerry was that he would anticipate, he would think. His mind was thinking about, well, this would please Aaron. And he would buy me some little thing or mention a book or give me something. And the friendship was constantly refreshed by his kindnesses, his little acts, what Wordsworth called little unremembered acts of kindness and of love. That's what friendship is about. And it surrounds your life with warmth. This is why much of schooling is about making and breaking friends, and at university as well. And it's there because the English don't have anything else. They don't have kinship, and they don't have what's called quasi-kinship in anthropology. They don't have things like adoption. Adoption was impossible in English law until the late 19th, early 20th century. There was no such thing as adoption in England. They don't have other things like blood brotherhood, milk brotherhood, godparent, which is unimportant, unlike Italy and the Mediterranean. And they don't have really patron-client relations, which are unequal ties based on patronage and clientship. It's an egalitarian society in certain respects, although hierarchical, as I pointed out as well. And therefore you make friends with people around in the same sort of social level as yourself. And that provides you with your important network. Anyway, I think I'll stop there and then we'll have the second half of the meeting.